Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
But kind of hard part as a millennial too is like we were told like, oh, if you work hard and like get a degree and XYZ, you'll like have the dream. And I think part of me is having to come to terms with I have done that and the math is not mathing to buy a house.
No, but you're living the dream, I think. Welcome to the Financials Podcast.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Future Rich. I'm your host, Barbara Ginty. I'm a CFP, and we are here with my guest today, Morgan. Hi, Morgan.
Hi.
Okay, so you said you're a millennial. So fill us in. How old are you? Where do you live? What do you do? How much do you make? I know we've done a little bit of a career pivot, nonprofit now. So yeah, give me all the details.
Yeah, sure. So I am 39. I live in Seattle. I work in HR for a tech company. It's kind of complicated to say what I make because at like many tech companies, my compensation is a combination of a base pay and an equity pay.
Okay.
So last year, I made about 185K total comp. And I actually just looked at my W-2 and that was like my Medicare wages. So I think that was my full comp for last year.
Including the equity, because they take the Medicare on that too.
Yeah, exactly. And then my base right now is about 140K. So that's what I'm working with like month to month net.
Yep.
And my net monthly is about $6,900 a month. This year, I feel like this is a little out of order.
That's okay.
I'm targeted to make, with stock where it is, about $55K in equity. So I'm looking at a total comp of around $195K this year. Okay. But like I said, it sounds like a lot, but it doesn't feel like a lot because it's 30% and, you know, I can't like live off my equity. Oh, and we vest equity twice a year.
Okay. And just a clarification, when you say equity, you did write in. So you're referring to, in this instance, restricted stock units.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not stock options. The taxation is a bit different.
Correct. Publicly traded company.
So we have RSUs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. We'll go through all the questions, but let's talk about, I agree with you because your base is high and your variable and equity component isn't what you live on. We can use that for other goals. But so what are your approximate monthly expenses? So you said you haven't bought, you're on the fence about real estate. So I was presuming you're renting?
Yes, I'm renting. Okay. My total monthly expenses, like all in with like, my rent and my utilities payments and all that is about $3,500 to $4,000 a month.
Okay. And what is rent? If you were to take that out because I always think that's interesting based on
Oh,
location.
well, that's why I'm not buying because my rent is only $1,600 a month right now, which is
Very
wild for
little. Yeah.
Seattle. Yeah, I mean, my place isn't super fancy or anything, but it's a good location, it's a good size. And when the reason I'm kind of a little bit turned off from buying is because when I look to buy in the Seattle area, my monthly all in for an equivalent space would be at least double what I pay. Yeah, it would be at, 7% with like 20% down, it would be in the 3,000 range, which that would reduce my ability to save and invest. So at least at this point, I'm thinking
And
it's
to
not
do
bad.
anything else, do
Correct. Correct.
anything else, like dinner,
Right.
gym, travel,
Travel. Yes.
anything else, you'd be house poor.
Exactly. And again, I'm single, and so yeah, that $3,500 a month or so is like a lot of my net monthly income. So yeah, it just scares me. I'm like, what if I lose my job? Not to mention just the idea of like being somewhere and being stuck and not being able to move without selling my property. So I'm kind of like trying to convince myself that I'm okay without that at this point.
Well, I think that there are pros and cons, and you will listen to some financial experts, and they say you should absolutely always buy. And then you'll have somebody on the other side of the spectrum who's like really believing in renting. And my personal take is it depends on the numbers, right? So, like what you just said, you have a great space, you're comfortable there, and it allows you the freedom to live the life that you want. And the other thing that I think people forget is like, if you really want to do real estate, you don't have to do real estate where you live. Like, it doesn't have to be a primary residence. It could be an investment property, right? And so there's other ways to think about real estate. And like, this is like a specific case that I have a person I work with. They live in a very high cost of living area. They are not going to retire there. So when the job is done, they have a good rent situation. They're saving a lot of money. And when they retire, they're going to buy a house. The complete opposite of what you're told your whole life, which is buy now and then downsize in retirement. And in retirement, this individual is going to own property for the first time ever.
That might make sense to me, especially because sometimes I'm looking at real estate and I see all these like cute properties, but it's like 55 plus community. And
If you don't buy now, it doesn't mean you can't buy in the future. You can do whatever you want. I think the key is when it comes to renting, is that the risk of not owning, I will say, I'll give you both. The risk of not owning is you get priced out of your community from a rent standpoint. That, like, in 10 years, your rent goes up and it would have been comparable for buying. So the people who had bought now are in a better position versus the people who rent. You can address that by saving.
Yes,
So
and
if you're renting and saving, you solve the problem, right? You could afford in the future. If you want to stay there at some point, buy if it makes sense for your life. The problem is when you only rent and you don't save, you can never afford to buy, and that puts you in a little bit of a predicament. But as long as you're saving and renting, that's fine. The numbers in this instance are more favorable for you. It allows you to save more and live a better lifestyle.
okay, that makes me feel a lot better. And I am saving, but I don't know if I'm saving, like the optimal right
Amount.
way to be setting myself up for that.
Okay, so let's talk about so your expenses, your housing, very reasonable at 1600 given what your take home is at 69, right? I really believe if you keep your housing costs low, people will be like, "Oh, it should be 30%." And I'm like, "Yeah, if you want to be the average American."
Right now I
But
think it's
like,
like 21% and I'm like, oh, that's great. And oh, I have
yeah, it's
money
more
that I,
comfortable.
right, exactly. I have money that I can play with and be comfortable and not really worry. I can't even tell you, like, having worked in nonprofit for so much of my early career and like really, being in places where like I'd get like a $400 car maintenance bill and I'd be like, oh my gosh, like I'm gonna have to like really think about how to pay for this over the next couple of months. To now, that just doesn't like scare me
It's
anymore. I mean,
nice to be comfortable.
it is nice to be comfortable. And I think that's what scares me about the whole, yeah, I'm like, why would I pay more for housing and put myself in an uncomfortable position related to other things again?
So I agree with you. I think that
Okay.
given that you have a very low cost of living, it gives you the flexibility to do other things. So let's just go through where you are from savings debt standpoint and make sure that you're saving enough so that should you want to buy down the road, you're financially prepared to do so if that at that point is in your best interest.
Okay,
you just perfect. Want to leave the door open. It doesn't mean you need to do it now. It doesn't mean maybe you don't buy a place until you're 70. Okay, so let's talk about, okay, so we have a good amount of money coming in net, and that's after, I'm presuming that's after your health insurance, and that's also after you're saving for your 401k. It's a publicly traded company, so 401k.
Yes, I max out my 401k every year. This is actually the first year I'm maxing. I actually made a mistake earlier in my time at this company because I didn't realize that my 401k contribution was only coming from my base and not everything. So I set my percentage a little bit too low, but this year I'm like, and then, you know, that percentage is low and you're like, oh, if I raise it up, I'm going to have less per month. And, you know, medical costs are rising and all that too. But I decided I'm just going to go for it. And at my income, I'm like, no, there's really no reason you shouldn't be maxing. So I'm maxing my 401k and I'm maxing my HSA.
Perfect. Okay. So your 401k, so for 2024, with your age, your maximum is going to be 23,000 that you're going to put in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Perfect. Okay. Perfect. And then you're matching your HSA.
Yes.
For 2024, your HSA limit is going to be 4,150. Okay. Perfect. So you're doing that too.
Yeah. And my company matches. We don't have a great 401k match. I think it's 2%. It's like 50 cents of the first 4%, which I'm like, isn't
works
that
out
2%?
To be. Yeah, it's 2%. Yeah, they always say it's.
They do it
figuring,
in a, they say it in
it's
a
so
weird way.
Confusing. It's always so confusing. Yeah. And I always have to ask like so many questions. I did like a presentation for a company and I was working with HR. And they gave me the math and I was like, I don't understand. And they're like, it's this. And I'm like, well, what? They have $100,000 salary. This gives like so convoluted, I thought. Yeah. And then the HR person was like, I don't know. I'm like, we need to check on the company match so we can figure it out.
I think they do it that way because it's not just like a straight 2%. It's not like you can put in 2% and they'll put in 2%. I think it's like, you have to put in 4% for them to
yes,
put in,
for putting
which is
2%.
Why they do it that way.
So it's,
yeah,
they do it that way. Because if it was two for two, then you'd only have to do two to get the whole two. They want you to do four and then they'll give you two. But some of them get really complicated. So if anyone's listening to this and you don't understand your 401k match, that's okay. Most people don't. And even sometimes I have questions on it when people give me the paperwork. I'm like, I want an example. You put in X, what does the company? Yeah, so 50% up till 4%, which works out to be two.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good. It's better than nothing. Always
better
good to
than
get something.
Nothing. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
And
okay. I've been there long enough that I'm fully vested on their match at this point, which is great.
Okay, good. So you're fully vested. How long was that to be vested? Was it three or
you
five?
To be fully vested at my company, you have to work, I think it's like 2 or 3 years. And I am hitting
oh,
4 years next month. So everything
yeah. okay.
is vesting now.
Perfect. Okay. So we're maxing out the 401k. We're maxing out the HSA. We're fully vested. And then from there, you have 6,900 to work with. Roughly our expenses, because rent is very low, which I love. I love a low housing cost. Honestly, I think it's such a game changer. It's 3,500. So at the end of the month, you really have what? Like another, we'll just ballpark 3,500, 3,400 to live on.
Yes. But I take of that amount, I save and invest 2,000 a month after.
Perfect.
Like,
that's fantastic.
From my after tax.
From your after tax. Okay. So then let's talk about where we are with savings and debt.
Okay.
So what do you have for retirement saved up? So I know you had wrote in a question about like a previous employer. So I'm assuming you have more than one retirement account.
Yes, I have 5 retirement accounts.
Oh, wow. We're just tacking them all on here.
I know. Yeah. Well, four of them are 401ks and one of them is actually a pension account. And
ooh.
Yeah, the pension is kind of tricky because I don't think there's any way for me to actually access it and look at it on a regular basis. But last time
nope,
I
that's pretty them, standard.
It is. Okay. I'm
yeah.
like, that's so weird and secretive. So I called them maybe a year ago and I was just like, hey, do I still have this? Like, can you tell me anything about it? And at the time they told me the balance was $48,750, which I think they said shakes out to like, you know, $200 a month. So it's not like anything I
You
mean,
know what? If anyone wants to send me money, I'm happy to take it.
exactly.
I
Yeah.
yeah, we don't turn down money. So if
Better
they
than
want to send,
nothing.
better than nothing. If someone wants to send you 200 in retirement, that's fantastic. So okay, so it's not going to be a game changer, but it'll be
Right.
nice.
Right.
200 in retirement.
Yeah, 200 like from the pen or something like that from the pension.
Okay.
And then across my other 401ks right now, the four, I have, it looks like about 252 or something. So about 300 between all five of those accounts.
Perfect. Yes. Okay. So just so you know how pensions work, what they will typically do for you when you get closer to retirement is you'll have the option, not always, I'm just making a making an assumption, which as we know, assumptions are not always right. But normally what you'll do is you'll have an option for a one-time payout on the pension or the monthly income.
Okay.
So I think it's fair to include the value of the pension where it is. It will not usually grow as quickly as like a 401k value, but you'll see what the value is at the time you get the election, usually, and it's a one-time election. So if you choose for the payout, that's it. It's done. There's no take backs, no change your mind with pensions. When you make an election, it's permanent.
Okay. So I know a pension is a defined benefit.
Benefit,
So when
correct.
they tell me now, like you'll get paid, you could get a payout of like $200. Is that like $200 in whatever, $2060, and the pension will
They're
grow?
estimating it.
Okay. So that value will grow to be able to maintain the payout they're quoting me today.
Depends on how they're quoting it. It might be a future projection of it should be $200 a month at age 65, and currently it's worth, we'll just say $40 a month. The current value is 48. It depends on how they're doing their projections.
Okay.
Because the current value, they said today's value, because it's a defined benefit plan. So there's a lot of people in the pension plan. So your calculation for your credits, right, for how many years you work there is worth 48,000. So it's I would need more information, but I think we could presume, my guess would be it's 200 in the future at retirement, and it'll be somewhere around the current value if you were to take a lump sum. Lump sums are usually allowed, you separate it from service. I don't know how many years you'll have to wait, depends on the plan document. But we've seen people be eligible to take a lump sum out of it as early as like 55. Depends on the plan. But I don't think we should overcount on that. So I would either use it as like 200 a month or the 48, but I wouldn't ever give it that much more until you get confirmation it is more.
Okay, got it. Yeah, it kind of feels like at this point, especially because I can't even like go to a website and look at it on any
No.
kind of regular, I kind of feel like it's just money that I should just kind of like forget about and treat as a bonus when I get
That's
there.
exactly. Generally, when people come in and say to me, I have a pension from a job that I'm no longer with. So if you have a job where you're like working there for the pension, right? Like the pension is the benefit. That's why we're there. Like my sister has a pension. We know exactly what it is. We know exactly what tier. It's part of her compensation. Why she makes less money is for this pension versus corporate America. Then we count it. But this is like kind of exactly, this is the cherry on top for you. This is like someone sends you a nice little check for 200 every month that you don't need, and it's a bonus. But
Okay,
we're not going to
perfect.
plan to live on this.
Okay, got it. Let's see. And I think I told you, yeah, it's about 252K in the 401s across four.
Okay.
I have about 50K in a taxable brokerage, and
Okay.
that is split about 80% stock in my current company and 20% stock in a mix of like other single stocks, but I've also been trying to invest more in like S&P 500 ETFs because
And
in
diversify.
yeah, and in my mind, the benefit to an ETF is like it kind of self-diversifies, like it's kind of diversified within the fund. In my mind, I'm like maybe it's less risky than like going out and buying a share of like, you know, Microsoft or something.
Okay, so an ETF is an exchange traded fund. So the difference between that and a mutual fund, both can be diversified depending on what you choose. So keyword, depending on what you choose. Some of them are more concentrated and are not as diversified. The big difference between an ETF is it trades throughout the day, more similar to a stock with multiple price points. And a mutual fund has an NAV, net asset value, and has one price at the end of the day, not tradable throughout the day. So an ETF and a mutual fund can both be diversified depending on which what and which you choose. The difference is the pricing of it, right? So one, you can get multiple price points, one you cannot. But from there, you still have risk. It doesn't self-diversify. But if you choose one that's a broad category, therefore there is more diversity, obviously, than a single stock. But you also want to be wary of like what you're choosing. There are some very concentrated ones, right, that would technically have more risk. But the big difference with an ETF, right, is it's traded multiple times throughout the day. That's the big difference. It trades more like a stock.
Okay.
The reason mutual funds and ETFs, the reason these the baskets of securities were created were to allow people with lower investable amounts, right, like you and I, to say, okay, I can have enough money to put in one company, but I don't have enough money to do that same amount in 50 companies, right? So therefore, these securities became available so that you have a basket of or exposure to a basket of securities. And that provides the diversification.
Okay.
The concept makes sense?
It does. And the reason that I started investing in an ETF, so I, right now, to kind of going back to my savings and debt, so I don't have any debt.
Okay, amazing.
The only debt I could see myself maybe taking on in the next year or so, unless like, you know, the best house in the world pops up and I decide to buy it, is my car is like a 2010. So I think I might, and it's running great. It's fine, but I kind of want a different car at some point. And I don't know, in my mind, and this is super scary, but I'm like, maybe I should just buy it in cash, which like writing a $45,000 check is scary, but I could also do it. And with car interest rates where they are, I'm like, that's probably a better idea.
Okay, so we have $50,000 in brokerage. What do we have in savings?
Oh, I have about $170,000 in savings.
Okay, yeah. I was like hoping we weren't going to take it out of the 401k. Okay, so we have $170,000. Amazing. Okay. And savings.
Yeah.
And that's just in cash.
Yeah. And that's in cash. And it's split between two high yield savings accounts. The only reason I have two is because in the middle of the pandemic, I was like chasing interest rates a little bit, but now they're the same. And so actually one of them has about 35,000 in it, which I'm like, okay, perfect. That's my emergency
car.
Fund then.
Oh, I was gonna say that's car money.
Or that's the car. Yeah. And the other one has the rest.
Amazing. Okay. So you have plenty of cash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so actually going back to the reason I was trying to like put money in investments is because I've noticed that, you know, I know high yield savings rates have been high for the past couple of years. So it's been, I've felt okay keeping my money in cash and like I'm getting a good return. But I've recently started to see my rates go down a little bit. And I know that the market tends to increase like over time better than a high yield account. So that's why I used to put the $2,000 a month in all in savings. Again, because I was like, oh, maybe I'm going to buy property. Maybe I'm going to buy a car, this, that, and the other. But now I'm splitting it and I'm putting still $1,000 in savings, but then $1,000 into the market.
The brokerage. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing that I'm planning to do too. So my next vest is in May and the vest is going to be about $46,000 or $47,000 gross. So
what are you doing for the tax?
So we have a couple of different options. So you can either input money to pay the taxes, which
with
seems
cash,
really,
you pay cash to get, so you get the full value of your restricted stock unit.
Right. Which seems a little bit goofy to me because it feels like, you know, if you want that stock, just buy it. Like a share is a share. I think the times when people input cash, it's because they have some kind of sentiment around like my first share or something. Mm-hmm. Then the other option is to sell to cover, which basically is when they sell enough shares to cover the taxes and then you keep the remainder, which is what I've done to have the shares that I do, the 40% of my tax, or the 80% of my taxable account. And then now though, I am selling everything. because I feel like I'd rather diversify that money
You're
than.
not hold, you're not holding it for a year to get capital gains on the remainder.
Well, I have a little over 200 shares that I have been
Okay.
holding for over a
Okay.
year, and those I'm
Okay.
keeping. But my understanding is if I sell the day I vest, I don't have to pay capital gains. And that's what I
No,
did
there should
all.
be, yeah, there should be no gain, right? Like
Right.
it should be a neutral, it should be a wash. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's what I did last year too. And it worked out okay on
Okay.
the taxes. So that's what I'm planning to do. And I'm, a
Okay.
little bit nervous because this is a big vest, but my plan is to sell all the day that I vest and then reinvest some of it, put some of it in savings, and actually open an IRA. So I think I'm over the income limit for a regular Roth, right?
There's only one type of Roth.
Okay,
There's a
because my
traditional and there's a Roth.
okay, I think it's the traditional because my friend was telling me that because he earns around the same as me, and he's like, well, you can put money into a traditional and then convert it to a Roth.
We just did a podcast episode on IRAs, and we did
Okay.
do the second part, which is so anyone who's listening who heard the first part about IRAs, and I went over Roth and traditional, and then I went over very briefly non-deductible. And then from there, we're going to have a second part, which we're going to do a little bit of a sneak peek today, which is where you do a non-deductible and convert it into a Roth. So the problem, which you currently just have all 401ks
Right.
at different workplace. We have a we're stacking them up. We have four.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So the good news is that what people don't talk about is when you do a non-deductible IRA, because you are not eligible for a deductible IRA, and you are also not eligible for a Roth IRA because you make good income, right? And so for a single filer in 2024, if you make more than $87,000 and you're covered by a workplace retirement plan, which you are not allowed to take a deduction on an IRA. You are also, as a single filer, making more than $161,000 in income, not eligible for a Roth IRA. What you are allowed to do a non-deductible, so it's a traditional IRA, but you get no tax break on it, and then convert it into a Roth. Now, where people make a misstep here is there is this thing called the pro rata rule that nobody talks about. So when you watch TikTok or a reel, and they're like, oh yeah, you should do a non-deductible and convert it. It's like, hold up, there are all these other rules that nobody is talking about. And when you do that, and if you don't meet all of the parameters for it, you get yourself into trouble. And so the pro rata rule is a real rule, and you should be wary of it. And also, there is documentation that you shouldn't immediately convert a non-deductible the same time. There should be a wait period. But you can, the pro rata rule, you will not run into because you don't have what's called mixed monies outside. So everything is a 401k. But one of your questions when you wrote in was, what do I do with all these 401ks, right? So if you want to do the non-deductible, then you should probably leave them at 401ks because the 401ks don't count when we're looking at a pro rata rule. But had you rolled those into an IRA and your friend at work said, hey, you should do a non-deductible, and he meant very well, and he didn't know that you had an IRA that had mixed money in it, you could have run into a pro rata rule. It's about mixing the money. Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should at least be simple. That's why for the last 3 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day with no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to take on my day. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. With AG1, I know I'm getting essential brain, gut, and immune health support with vitamins, probiotics, and nutrients from Whole Foods. I like to think of it as my nutritional insurance. I know I'm covering my nutritional bases from the very start of the day. If there's one product I had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why I've partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/futurerich. That's drinkag1.com/futurerich. Check it out. And sometimes what we see with people is they do the non-deductible, they forget and they don't convert it, and now it grows. So now you have two types of money in one account. You have a non-deductible dollar and you have a non-tax, right, growth. So you have two types of money. So it's not as straightforward as everyone makes it out to be. It can easily be solved if you're asking all the right question and you know all the right rules. The warning here on this podcast is just because your friend at work says it's a great idea does not mean they know your entire situation. And this is what happens to people is the intention is well-meaning, right? It's a good intention, but everyone's finances are different. And so when you're considering a non-deductible Roth conversion, you should 100% seek the advice of a financial advisor, and you have to tell them everything about your situation. You have to disclose all things. If they don't know everything about you, they cannot give you advice. Or a tax professional. And once again, they need to know everything, can't hide anything, because they can't give you the appropriate direction if they don't know everything that's happening. Does that make sense?
Okay, that makes sense. And yeah, he was just like, oh, you can save $7,000 more per year towards retirement if you do this. So, And again, I was thinking like, oh, I have this Beth coming up. I'm gonna have a stack of money. I can just take 7,000 of it and put it in this other account.
But so the way I like to do it, because 7,000, yeah, that's great. The way I prefer to do it, and you said you work for a tech company, is oftentimes, not all tech, but oftentimes tech company 401k plans are pretty progressive in that they allow three money types inside of their plan. And so what is called a mega backdoor Roth, and the reason I like this better is because you're all doing it in the construct of a 401k, which is a defined contribution plan, which does not run into the pro rata rule, is do you have a non-deductible contribution election for your 401k with an in-plan conversion option?
That's a great question and something I'll have to look into.
Because that is your better option.
Okay.
And working for a tech company, it's worth investigating, because oftentimes tech companies, and I will preface it with a lot on the West Coast, right? Because we have a lot of tech on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't run into a plan yet on the West Coast that doesn't have it. So, you know, you could be my outlier here, but they oftentimes allow for a non-deductible contribution because tech employees are highly paid. And the people that set up these plans, who start these businesses, are well aware of all the tax loopholes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how to take advantage. And so often they allow for a non-deductible contribution. So you max out your pre-tax option at work, which you're doing. You then add a non-deductible contribution. So instead of having it come through your paycheck and going $1,000 for you to put invest, it's the same, no tax break. It goes $1,000. You leave it, not invest it, because we can't have growth like you're talking about. And then you can do an in-plan conversion into the Roth. And then from there, there is a much higher limit. Do you know what the limit is on that one?
Tell me.
It is the limit on defined contribution plans, total dollars allowed, is $69,000.
Wow. Okay.
But yeah. Like, that's your better, if that's available to you, that's your better option than managing it outside of your workplace plan, is managing it through your defined contribution plan, because your company is putting in 2% on what you're putting in, and you're putting in 23. Let's just say all in, it's 25,000. So 69,000, right, is your defined contribution limit. That's total dollars allowed. That's employee and employer contribution. And then this non-deductible would be able to fill the bucket. So you could, in theory, be able to put another 44,000 into a Roth inside of your workplace plan, if you have these two constructs, which is a non-deductible contribution and an in-plan conversion.
And so does that work? Like, it would take money out of my paycheck after, so it would reduce that 6,900, but.
Yeah, it would reduce it, but you're taking the 6,900 and taking 1,000 and putting it in your account and investing it. This would be, you would get, we'll just say you do 1,000 a month. You're going to get 5,900. The same effect is going to happen, but you have an in-plan conversion. So you're able to do, in this example, we're doing 1,000 a month for the calendar year. You're able to put 12,000 into a Roth, all with inside your workplace plan. You're eliminating a lot of the steps you're going to be doing on your own.
Okay. How do I decide though, if you have any advice on this, like, how do you decide like how much, cause I feel like money I'm saving towards retirement is like locked away for decades. And the reason I kind of like the taxable brokerage instead of just straight high yield savings is because I feel like that money, you know, keeping capital.
You have access.
Kept in mind. Yes, I can like access it if I need it for something.
So here's my argument. If you have one of these tech 401ks that allows for what's considered, it's there's all different words for it. We'll just call it the mega backdoor Roth because the amount that you can fund into the Roth is substantial. If you have that available to you, that is not a workplace plan benefit that you will have available to you unless you stay in tech on the West Coast. There are some East Coast, like I worked at an investment bank, we had it as well. So there are some other companies. It's not that common. And you know, when we get off the podcast, you can tell me what company. I have a running list of who has them. I just don't want to break the anonymity here. But if you have that available to you, I say use it because that is something that you most likely won't have at every company. So take advantage of that while you can. But I agree with you that I like to have all money types.
Mm-hmm.
Just to hate on TikTok for a minute. When you go onto TikTok, they're like, only have Roth. And it's like, no. You have to base it on your current tax situation, your predicted future tax situation, and it all evens out depending on where taxes fall. My objective is usually to try and get people to have all different types of money, right? Because mm-hmm. then depending on where we are on tax depends on where we pull money from, right? So if we have IRA, Roth, and non-tax, you're in a great situation. We have all three money types and we determine what money we pull from depending on where we are tax-wise because nobody knows what's going to happen in 30 years, right? So you might as well have a bunch of horses in the race. So I agree that if you have a mega backdoor Roth available, we take advantage of that because that's a unique opportunity that's presented to you, but also then find a balance between doing that. So we could split the difference and do 1,000 into that if it's available, and then 1,000 still into the brokerage. And with your vesting, with your RSUs and with the full sale, you'll still accrue cash or mm-hmm. cash, you know, private money. I will tell you the other nice thing about having a brokerage account, it depends on where it's being held, but to keep in the back of your mind, you can borrow against those types of investments, like you can borrow against a house. So if someone was like, well, you need a house because you can borrow against it. Well, if you continue to accrue non-retirement assets, which you will with the RSUs vesting and selling and diversifying, when that account starts getting up to we get that to 250, you can borrow up to about 50% of value in a line of credit, like you would a house.
Against your taxable brokerage account.
Yep, wow. Against your non-retirement account. Because the reason why I call it private money is because mm-hmm. your Roth and your IRA, you're partnered with the IRS, whether you like it or not. You have a partner there, and that's the government, because it's a retirement plan that's allowing you those vehicles. You have private money, the IRS is not your partner. You have you have to pay taxes on capital gains, but that is your money and you can take a loan against it, depending on who's holding your money. Not every firm offers that, but that is available to you.
Okay, that's super helpful to know. And it kind of makes me feel a little bit better because, yeah, I mean, at this point, it's like, I feel like I'm in a pretty good place just because I have some money, I don't have debt, but I'm like, oh, like, am I making... At my age, like I said, I'm 39. I'm like, am I doing the right thing? I don't want to be misstepping. And it sounds like if I just keep kind of piling money in places.
Yeah, you have almost 500. If we count the pension, you have over 500,000. You're in a great spot. I think the key is what you said is like, let's take advantage of unique opportunities. It's a unique opportunity to have a mega backdoor Roth available to you. While okay. you can't take a loan against it, I think we could split the difference. I definitely think you should be doing the pre-tax and a high cost of living. If we can add the Roth inside of your workplace plan so that you could do 10 or 12,000 as well into that. And then mm-hmm. I would agree with you, the rest of the RSUs, I would diversify. When you have a more diversified portfolio, you are able to get a higher percentage loan to you.
Okay.
So yeah, if you end up with 250,000 in one stock and you wanted to take a loan against that to use for a down payment for an investment property or what have you, or whatever you want to use it. It's just an available option because you have a tangible asset. If it's a concentrated portfolio, they're going to loan less because there's more risk. So if it's a diversified portfolio, you can, not guaranteed, but they usually loan around 50% of value.
So if I keep piling money into an ETF, is that considered diversified or no? Because it's like, it's like one share of a bunch of.
So I would say that as long as it's a diversified ETF, you shouldn't have a problem. But one single stock, they will loan less because if something happens to one company, which if you look at history happens all the time that people lose their shirt because the company was amazing, was amazing, was amazing, and overnight it wasn't, and that was all the stock. But so just keep that in the back of your mind, because I'm sure when you're talking about the housing thing, that's one thing that people will say, well, like, well, you have a tangible object you can loan against. And it's like, yeah, so are investments. Those are tangible objects that you can get a line of credit against. Now, whether it works out, like right now, you don't want to take a line of credit because interest rates are high. Same with a home equity line of credit, interest rates are high, but you will, but you have that, that's a feature, right? So I think that's an important thing to keep in the back of your mind, that you don't have to have real estate. You can also have an investment account, and the borrowing is similar.
Okay. Last question, going back to my 401ks really quick, that, you know, my collection, I have never rolled them over. And it's funny because my justification for never rolling them over, especially like I have two in one brokerage and then two in other ones. So I actually look at the two in my current brokerage all the time. And it's funny because it's my current 401k and the 401k I signed up for when I was like 22. And my current one is in a target date fund. And my old one is in like just a really random hodgepodge. I mean, I was 22. I feel like I kind of went through and was like, that's a cute name.
Like, yeah, I like that one.
Yeah. And but like sometimes on a daily basis, it actually does a little bit better than my
than the target. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I cannot tell you why. It's like pure dumb luck. But do I need to be rolling them over? And like to your point earlier, should I be rolling them over into an IRA? Should I be rolling them into a 401?
Yeah. Okay. So here's, so there's a legal answer for this, like a compliance answer, which is, I think the form they give you is like, you have three options. You can leave it, which is what we've done. You can roll it over, or you can cash it out. Now, obviously the cash out is not ideal with your tax bracket. We don't want to be liquidating, but that is an option. You can always liquidate. So there's three real options, right? And you choose what is your best option. So based on our conversation today, I would say not doing an IRA is probably advantageous to you in case that this mega backdoor Roth is not available. You want to be able to do the non-deductible conversion. And so therefore you don't want to have IRAs. You technically can have IRAs because there's no mixed money in it, but you just want to not get sloppy with the convert. Because if you have IRAs and you get sloppy with a non-deductible, like you do one and then you never roll it, then we can creep into pro rata land, and we don't ever want to go to pro rata land. Like you want to stay out of pro rata land, right? So my thought would be a couple things. If the investments are doing well and you have updated beneficiaries, because at 22, that might be a different person than at 39, and you like the investments, there's nothing wrong with leaving them as long as you're monitoring them, right? Or you could move them all over to your current workplace plan and just have one 401k if they allow it. You have to ask them. I will tell you the reason. So some of the target date funds are good. You have to look at the historical performance on them. Basically, that's a basket of investments they've picked for you. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes if you just pick your own basket of funds, like you did at 22, where you say, okay, here is the menu they've given me, and I'm going to choose these five funds off the menu rather than them choosing the five they're going to package together. Sometimes the individual selections combined, depending on how you pick, can do better depending on what is in that basket you picked, because they put it together for you. The target date is a basket of various investments, right?
Okay.
So you just want to go, there's nothing wrong with like picking.
Well, it's just funny the days that it does better, because I'm like sitting there looking at it and like my target date 401k is down and my like random selection is, I'm like, am I Warren Buffett like secretly?
So what you want to do is, you don't want to get too hung up on daily, right? Because you're not in it for the day. We're in it for 30 years. So you want to look at your average, like long-term, like how have I done year over the year? How have I done 3 years and 5 years, and then kind of compare. But I do encourage people, like, you don't have to do the target date. Like you can look at what's available to you and look at, you can make your own little basket if you'd like. That's your choice. And sometimes with the plans, which I think is good, is if you don't pick anything, they auto select for you. There's a default. Like if you've chosen nothing, they default you to like a set retirement plan. Like your target date is your retirement in theory at 65. So you're in that one. So okay. Yeah, so the long and short of it is, it's personal decision. There's a lot of options. I would say at this point, if I were in your shoes, I would maybe try and keep everything inside of the 401k. Just it keeps everything really clean. from that standpoint, in case you're not going to be doing a mega bet back or a Roth, you would just then have the non-deductible converted, and that's your only vehicle outside of the defined contribution plan.
And is that considered on a yearly basis? So, like, if I'm doing the in-plan conversion this year and then I leave tech next year, then I could potentially, and I don't have the conversion, then I could potentially roll over into an IRA and not worry about going to pro rata land. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and you won't probably hit pro rata land even if you roll everything to an IRA because it's not mixed money. It's only if you did the non-deductible. And I see this because I see all sorts of crazy things. And you're like, okay, I'm going to convert it. And then the form you submit or you call and they actually don't do it, like they forget or something happens. And then you go to the end of the year and it was never converted and it grew, let's say it grew tremendously. And it's like, oh, now we have two types of money. So then you would just pay taxes on the converted amount. But remember, you'd have to pay like separately because if you paid out of the account, which people do, then it's an under 59 and a half distribution because you're 39 and you paid tax, you took a distribution to pay tax. So it seems really straightforward and generally it can be, but there are booby traps, is what I like to tell people.
Okay, got it.
And I'm sure I'm going to get some heat being like, it's not that hard. And it's like, well, I see everybody who screws it up, you know? Like they come to my office when they're like, so I did this non-deductible and then I don't know what happened, but like I never converted it. And it's been, we had someone on the show and it was like 10 years or something, never converted it.
And it just grew.
Yeah, well, it was invested, of course. That's what you want it to do. You want it to grow. We don't want it to go down for 10 years.
But do you have to do something to invest? I guess you do. Because you hear of all these people too who like put
Yes, who like
money
leave it
at
in cash.
yes. Oh, that's the other thing. Speaking of like leaving things in cash or investing, I actually just invested a little bit of my HSA for the first time too. Because
Oh, good.
I was like, oh, you
Yeah.
can like invest a portion. Because similar to the whole leaving in cash, I was just like, why do I have all this cash sitting
And that
there?
can be used down the line for retirement if it's not all used. It's not like an FSA. If you don't spend it, you don't lose it. It can be used for retirement.
Right. And I figure I can safely invest anything over my out-of-pocket maximum and be
Correct.
fine.
Yeah. And you also will be fine because you also have cash.
That's true.
Yeah, you have plenty of you're
I
not going,
like
you are not running into problems, my dear. Yeah.
traditional millennial though, it's like I do have anxiety around it. And especially, like I said, I work in HR for a tech company. So like I make good income for HR and a tech company and a single earner, but you know, I work next to these people who are bringing in like 400,000 or 500,000 a year. And so it's hard.
You probably have more money. The people who you think have money, 9 out of 10 times, there's always outliers, but 9 out of 10 times, the people who you think have money, who have the fancy cars, the fancy house, fancy handbags, almost always never have money because they're spending everything on the lifestyle. And so then the saving is secondary. So you probably have more money.
Okay.
Not to say that it's a competition, but like you're making very conscious decisions to set yourself up financially. And one of the biggest decisions you've made is to not get caught up in you should buy a house when it's not the best financial decision for you. So you're giving yourself all of this freedom and flexibility. If you got laid off tomorrow, you don't have a problem. You can just go say, you know what? I'm going to get rid of my apartment and travel for a year. Not many people can do that. You could easily be like, I'm going to put my stuff in storage and travel until I get my next job. Like you'd be completely fine. You have set yourself up with the amount of money that you have in non-retirement that will count the 50,000 in brokerage and the 170,000 in saving. I mean, your expenses, if you got rid of your apartment, I mean, you could just travel forever.
Yay.
Right? I mean, if you think about it from that standpoint, like you're setting yourself up by like living well below your means, right? And structuring it with all different types, right? Like we're doing the non-retirement, which is an asset that you can borrow against in the future should you have a problem and need a line of credit or whatever, you have that available to you, or you will. You could just throw the 170,000 in cash in there and borrow against that too. But you're putting all the things right. And I think really honestly, the key is you're maxing out your retirement and you're keeping your costs super low and you haven't gotten caught up in the what you see online, which is like you should buy a house. Like, well, no, that's crazy. You'd have a beautiful house that you would sit in and you'd have a lot of financial stress, especially if the roof went for 30 grand or whatever. That would be like a real bummer.
Yeah. Well, and that's the hard part today is I'm just like, how are people affording this? Like the kind of hard part as a millennial too is like we were told like, oh, if you work hard and like get a degree and XYZ, you'll like have the dream. And I think part of me is having to come to terms with I have done that and the math is not mathing to buy a
No,
house.
you're, but you know, but you're living the dream, I think. Think about this.
Okay.
You have no student loan debt, zero. You have no credit card debt.
Well, I
You
have student
have,
loan debt. I've paid it off.
right. So you, but I think you're, so you have $500,000 currently saved without adding another dollar at 39. If it just continues average, I'm using 7.2% compounding interest. For everyone listening at TikTok, do not use anything higher. That's still a high number, textbook wise. I'm using a high compounding of interest at 7.2%. That makes 1 million at 49, not adding a dollar. That makes 2 million at 59. And I'm going to go to 69 because statistically we should live to like 88, so that's a 20-year retirement. And then at 69, that's 4 million.
Wow,
4
okay.
million. Yeah, I mean, this is a projection at 7.2% compounding interest. No guarantees. Who knows what it'll actually be? But if we use, and I'm using 7.2% because if you're in the market for that long, statistically you should do a little bit better, but I want to be moderate. So at 4 million, if you take 4% off that number, that's 160,000 a year at a 4% distribution rate.
Which is great, which would allow me to basically live at my current income.
Correct. Yeah. And we have to do inflation. Someone say, well, 3% inflation, that's not including what you would get from Social Security. You're a high income earner. You'll probably pull in. And I don't believe anybody who says we won't have Social Security. There are 66 million recipients on Social Security. That is a hell of a lot of people if those checks don't go out. I mean, 66 million is more than a lot of countries. Can you imagine if all of a sudden the checks stop? Like, we're going to have a massive problem in on our hands in this country. So let's just assume you're still going to be getting Social Security, and let's just say that's going to be 30 to 40,000. That brings you up to 200, and you don't need as much money generally in retirement because you're not traveling to work. Your retirement spending goes up in the beginning and then goes down. I have a lot of women who are in their 80s who are in fantastic physical shape. They don't really feel like flying. Can they afford to fly? Absolutely. Do they want to fly? Not as much. Your spending
Okay.
doesn't usually go like straight up in your 80s. You have more medical costs, generally speaking, but usually there's a spike in spending in retirement and it levels out. But yes, so right now, and that's without saving another dollar. So I actually think you are living the dream. I would
Okay.
challenge you that if you want to take a vacation, you don't have to say, I don't know, I don't think I can afford it.
Okay. Should I be doing anything else with that 170, or should I be like not
I
putting
wouldn't
another dollar in
leave.
cash and putting more in?
I wouldn't put any more in cash. If anything, I would say you could probably pull some out and invest it, and you could dollar cost average it. You don't have to do it all at once, but you could start putting some money from cash into the market long term. Even if you paid for a car in cash, which you can afford to do and not have any debt, you would still have like 100, even if you spend 40, 130,000 in cash, your living expenses are like 3,500 a month. You don't really need to have that much in cash. You could live for a very long time. If you feel comfortable, I have no issue with it because you're saving enough outside of it. But you could even take some out. You could put 30,000, leave 100 in cash, 40s for the car, 30 goes into the market, and that would be a good spot. And then continue with all new money is invested.
Okay. Yeah, it's hard because the money that I've invested up to this point in like ETFs and different things, some of the like single tech stocks I have are doing better than my high yield, but I've been dollar cost averaging into these like each S&P 500 ETFs since like the beginning of the year, and they're like at 2%. So I'm kind of like, it would have been making more in my high yield, but I have
But
to
look
remind
at,
myself it long
it's 30
term.
years. Yeah, we want to look at 30 years. Yeah.
Okay.
And you have enough cash that if there's an emergency, you're fine. You can live comfortably in your existing situation if you have 100,000 in cash for 3 years.
Okay. This was super helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. But I think you're doing a great job. I think the issue we're going to see this year is with inflation. I think we're going to see a lot of people that are really getting in trouble with credit card debt. I'm already seeing it substantially, a substantial increase in my own day to day. And I have like a set demographic that I'm meeting with, right? And with the podcast, like we do 40 episodes a year. It's a good amount of people, but it is a subset of the United States. And I'm already seeing a huge uptick in credit card debt where it's getting out of, like where their people are just getting stuck and they're not
Yeah.
living extravagantly. It's just,
I feel like that's where my early years working in nonprofit and really being kind of paycheck to paycheck and having to learn to budget has really helped me because I actually do put most everything on a credit card every month, but like I pay it in full, you know, and I kind of keep a running tab on what I'm accruing. You know, I very rarely get to the end of the month and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm surprised to
Had
have a
no idea.
$3,000 credit card bill. Yeah, it's like I kind of keep track as I go, which I think is really helpful.
And those are really good habits. And if you did that for a long time, they're ingrained usually. I start also started out on a very tight budget moving to Manhattan. And so my rent was the majority. I had $400 left over after rent for my Metro card, my dry cleaning, and my food. I was also so skinny. It was a great diet because I ate. My boss was like, "What are you eating for lunch?" I was like, "Whatever's free in the building." Like, I would go to conference rooms. I was like eating cereal. She was like, "You need to go buy food." And I was like, "I have no money." I was like, my parents would drop off like a Costco bag of pasta, and that was my dinner for like every night. So when you get those habits early, as you move up in income and you can maintain those habits and not have that lifestyle creep, that's where you really see a huge difference in your financial life with the increase in income, because you didn't just say, okay, I'm making more now, I get a nicer car. I'm making more now, I get a bigger house. I'm making more now, right? You're actually changing your financial trajectory with the income difference because you have that discipline and those habits from early on when you didn't have that bandwidth financially.
Okay. So what I'm hearing from this is I need to give myself a little bit more credit and stop feeling so anxious
Yes.
about things.
Yeah, I
Okay.
wouldn't feel anxious. And like, here's the way to think about it. You keep saving at the rate you're saving with cash, you're going to have no issue getting up to $500,000 in cash. If you decide down the road that you want to buy a house, you can afford to do it. You'll have more than enough money saved to do it. And at that point, it's a choice. Does buying a house serve you and your goals, or doesn't it? And I just think you just always need to remember, just because it's right for somebody else does not make it right for you. And just because you decide today that buying a house is not right for you, that doesn't mean that doesn't change.
Right. It just makes me nervous because you hear all these people say, like, oh, if you don't buy now, you're going to get locked out of the market. But I feel like that is for people who aren't continuing to save. I feel like
That's
if you
correct.
really are saving the difference between your current housing costs and what a house would cost, you are not in that situation.
Okay, so I'll give you a perfect example. So this is, so my parents bought their house, I think it was for like $70,000, right? Low. Interest rate was 18%. My parents sold their house for 450,000. They didn't make money on that. They put a pool in, they put an addition in, they put on a new roof, they put in landscaping, they had a new septic that had to go in, they had to put a fence in, they had to do the driveway multiple times.
And they're doing that on their weekends. Whereas for me, like my
Correct.
dishwasher goes out and I call the landlord and I'm like, hey, come in whenever, put in a new one.
And so I said to my parents, and they missed the market, like they sold too early. They could have made another $200,000. We checked the listing. The woman who bought the house from them is selling it. They haven't even changed the paint that I selected when I was 11. I was like, let's do bright yellow in the basement. And I don't know. My parents were like, what color does your sister want? And she wanted bright blue. It's the ugliest paint job you've ever seen. I don't know why anyone would let a 10 and an 11-year-old pick paint colors, but we picked the most obnoxious colors. It's still that color. She's reselling it for like 700, and she'll probably get it. And I said to my parents, aren't you upset? And my dad was like, I've never been happier not owning a house. I don't have to worry about the toilets. They live in a condo. It's very much smaller space. And he's like, I've never been happier. I don't deal with problems on the weekend. On the weekends, I sit by my pool. And so there's a lot to be said for that. And so, yeah, some people make a killing on their primary residence, but not everybody does. And remember, the housing market crashes on average. Like, it'll probably crash at some point. It crashed in 2008. House wasn't worth nearly what you thought it was. Yes, home ownership can be a valuable asset for some people. You're going to have a valuable asset in your investment portfolio. You're going to have assets that you can also borrow against and that would allow you to buy a home should that be the right decision for you. But I think there's a lot to be said for being like, hey, this is broken. Please come fix it. I'll be in Hawaii this week.
Because I can afford it because my housing costs are so low.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
And it's not permanent. If you say, in 5 years, the interest rates, let's say, have, well, I don't think they're going to go down. Seven is an average for 30 years, but let's say they're 6%. and you find a cute little cottage that works for you, or maybe you meet somebody and now you're going to share housing costs and you decide you want to buy, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can decide to buy. You're right. Financially capable. Just don't get caught up in what other people are doing. Not everybody makes the best financial decisions. And we know that if you listen to the podcast, a lot of people maybe that present are doing well, not always doing well, unfortunately. And just because it's right for somebody does not make it right for you. I think you've done a great job. You've paid off your debt. You have no credit card debt. You're cash flush. You're making great income and you have low housing costs. I mean, I think the world is your oyster.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming on. Did I answer all your questions?
Yes, you did. Thank you so much. This is super helpful.
Okay, good. I'm glad. So for all of our lovely listeners, if you like the show, do us a favor, please, and subscribe and leave us a rating. And you can follow us on Instagram for our most up-to-date information. Time for our disclaimer. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance references are historical and do not guarantee future results. Make sure that you consult with your own legal, tax, and/or financial advisor before making any decisions.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.